are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. If you want a view into the world that lies behind the Ted Bundy murders, this last work in a series of six books on Bundy is definitely for you. For within these pages, you'll read of the many questions still surrounding this fascinating and intricate case, as well as the answers that are only now being provided here. There's so much more to learn, and new information is still surfacing about Bundy, his victims, and his potential victims. As such, there is new testimony, including from those who had a brush with the killer and others who played their own roles in this multi-state case. In this book, Bundy case detective Jerry Thompson of Salt Lake City, Utah, and Don Patchen of Tallahassee, Florida, talk about their personal experiences with Bundy. So does Ron Holmes, the Louisville criminologist who worked with the killer towards the end of his life. Also included are official reports that have rarely been viewed outside of the archives, along with the author's commentary to guide readers through them. And last but not least is Bundy's final confession to Utah Detective Dennis Couch just hours prior to Bundy's execution. In it, Bundy reveals startling facts and sparks additional questions. A must-read for those true crime readers fascinated by America's most enigmatic and infamous serial killer. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Enigma of Ted Bundy, The Questions and Controversies Surrounding America's Most Infamous Serial Killer, with my special guest, journalist and author, the world's resident expert on Ted Bundy, Kevin Sullivan. Thank you so much for this interview, and welcome back to the program, Kevin Sullivan.
Well, thanks, Dan, for having me back. I know we always have a great time when we talk about Ted Bundy and other killers, so I expect it to be an excellent show.
Absolutely. It's always fascinating talking to you about Ted Bundy, and I marvel, as many people do, I imagine, that there is never too much information about Ted Bundy, and you have provided, once again, some surprising and incredible new information, and it's like reading a brand new case. It's incredible. Tell us, with this book, as you write, what you are tackling. You're tackling a number of questions, speculations, and controversies that have surrounded the Ted Bundy case for many years. What are you adding with this book? What specifically is in this for those Ted Bundy fanatics and for those that have read the previous six Ted Bundy books that you've written?
Sure. Well, you know, this sixth book, The Enigma of Ted Bundy, is a culmination of a series of six books totaling over 1,400 pages. And I really believe that was going to be the last book that I would write. But I keep getting new information coming to me all the time, and so I'm gathering even more information now. But the thing, and I figured, you know, and all the people that read my books agree with it. Why should I receive the information and let it sit in my file drawer? So as stuff comes to me, I'll be publishing things in the future. But this last book of the main six books, I wanted to do something a little different. I wanted to create a book that could tackle a lot of the questions and controversies about Bundy. Cover the types of things that you can't cover when you're writing. For example, when I wrote my flagship book, The Biography of Ted Bundy, The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, and then the companion volumes that I've had since then. You could do a little bit in there, but I wanted Enigma to really just focus on some things that had not been covered before, and that's one of the reasons why I added the transcripts that I had originally done of the interviews of Don Paxson, Jerry Thompson, and Ron Holmes back in 2007 and 2008 when I was doing research for my book, The Bundy Murders. Now, I had not listened to these tapes for a long time. It had been many years. And, of course, The Bundy Murders, the first edition came out in 2009. It was re-released as a updated, expanded version April 2020. But I had quoted from these men, not just from those tapes a little bit, but I've had so many conversations with them off tape. I've quoted from them in the book, The Bundy Murders. But back and listen to these books, these tapes, and I turned them into transcripts for the book, and it was almost like listening to them for the first time, and I thought, this is going to be really great for the reader to get down into print for Enigma. Because, for example, Jerry Thompson passed away about a year and a half ago, and then Ron Holmes is gone as well. So I was wanting to do that. So I wanted to get a lot of things in there, look at Bundy from a number of angles, as well as reproduce some of the case file material that most people will never be able to read. And then have commentary along, you know, with that. So I wanted to make Enigma rather unique. And as I went through the book, and as I finished the book, I think I was successful in doing so.
Right. It's also fascinating. You just talked about these files, but they're the supplementary reports. So we're actually reading some of the things that people could read, police officers could read, if they had access at that time. And it's fascinating.
Yes.
You start with an officer receives a call from Chief Anderson and a Mr. Richard Mahan, and called and said his daughter Margaret had some information about the Bundy case. Just to demonstrate, this is the opening supplementary report. Tell us a little bit about this supplementary report and what his daughter Margaret was reporting about Bundy. Specifically,
yeah. Well, Margaret Maughan lived at 565 First Avenue in Salt Lake City, and she knew Ted well. And she I think I quote her a couple of times in the supplementary reports that I've added in different places, But Maughan, when she was interviewed by by all the detectives, she noted that the passenger seat on Bundy's Volkswagen would rock back and forth. And, of course, the reason for that, and the investigators knew this after they learned that Bundy was constantly taking that passenger seat out and putting it back in, and by doing so, kind of tight-fitting aspect of it was gone. And she said she used to have to hold on, that seat would rock back and forth. But Margaret knew him. She liked Bundy. Her father was on the, as I recall, the state Supreme Court of Utah. And after Bundy got in trouble, he had to recuse himself because obviously he had met Bundy and had some dealings with him and, of course, knew him through his daughter. But if you read her testimony, it's just very interesting. And what these people do who knew Bundy, either hunted him and had dealings with him or, were friends with him, it really is a window into, Bundy's life and what came forth. And there's another thing that I was wanting to do in those supplementary reports. When I wrote the Bundy Murders, I included just a portion of the cat and mouse thing that Bundy had with the Seattle cops when he had gone home from Utah in December of 1975, having been released from jail on bail, and they knew Bundy was coming, and they tracked him, and they surveilled him for a couple of months before he went back home. That went over so well. People loved that so much from the Bundy Murders that I didn't use them all. I included the rest of those in other companion volumes. Well, when I was doing Enigma, I thought, I want to add the surveillance tapes of the Utah cops, and so I've got those in there too. But you'll find in these supplementary reports, I'll tell you one thing really great about them. When I was writing the Bundy murders and I was dealing with the official records, what you do when you're writing narrative nonfiction, you're telling a story. You don't replicate the reports. You write your story based on what's in the reports, and then you can add squibs here or there of the reports. That's just normal. But I remember when I was writing, you know, the Monday murders, I thought, well, it would be so great if people could see the full reports. And so, you know, you can't do that when you're writing something like a biography. It's just not done. But in the companion volumes, you were able to bring some of that out with commentary. Like for this, for me, if to somebody else, I've read other supplementary reports and other people's books, not about Bundy, but other things, and the author will speak about something and say, here's the report on that or whatever. So it's very, very interesting stuff. So when you look back at this thing, what's an enigma about Margaret Maughan, her father's in a position in the court system, he had to recuse himself later, and just what she says about dealing with Bundy, it's a great window into what happened, you know, during that time.
You talk about a great window. You actually have starting in September 7th, 75, you have it talks about the interview of Elizabeth Klopfer, and everybody knows who that is in terms of Ted Bundy, and talks like she works at the University of Washington Medical Institute. Tell us just a little bit about what was very interesting when you did, having written all these books, and then you saw the actual supplementary reports. What was most interesting or fascinating or stood out for when you reviewed those actual supplementary reports, the police interaction and phone calls with Elizabeth?
Yeah, you know, I actually included, I think, the entire thing in Enigma. I've touched on that before. And I remember when I was interviewing Jerry Thompson, in fact, Jerry was just, he was just really a great guy. He was always helpful. I had two face-to-face interviews with him, which were quite substantial interviews both times. And yet we talked on the phone at other times. We emailed each other. He always gave, like I like to say, additional clarification when I stumbled on something and I needed to know more. And so many things came out with Jerry, about these various interviews he did with people, and as well as Liz. And, you know, he said she was extremely nice, and none of the investigators were really upset with her, that she kind of bounced back and forth with Bundy, hoping he's not him and then believing that he probably is and thinking, no, it couldn't be. So the detectives kind of understood what kind of quandary that she was in. But those interviews that they did with her were very eye-opening as to the nature of Bundy. And if you look at what she had to say to these detectives, and she would end up having great guilt for them, because she would be in these periods, she'd think, you know, she'd get back around Bundy and we just can't be, and then she'd have guilt for having talked to the cops. And I remember when she admitted to Bundy that she did, I wrote in the Bundy murders that it must have been like having a knife in the gut for him to hear that she actually talked with him. But she was honest. And but she was, you know, just, she was very forthright with them. Jerry and some other detectives, Beale, and Balanfold, they flew up to Seattle to see her, and met at the, I believe, the King County Ted Task Force office where, you know, Keppel was. So they had this great interview, and it wouldn't be the last time. And I remember in one of the interviews, I think the one that happened in Enigma, she's asking questions. She's not just answering questions, but she's asking questions. And, you know, she heard about a rapist in the Avenues, and Bundy, in the vernacular of the day, it's not how people, thank God it's not how people talk now, but Bundy tried to blame it on, what he said was retarded people that lived around the corner. Probably a good chance it was Bundy committing some of these rapes. It may not be, but it's real funny that he lived in the avenues and these things were going on. And so I guess there were occasions where Bundy would, he is suspected anyway of raping some people, but maybe not murdering them when it was rape only. But most of his activity with women, as you well know, it had to do with murder. And because that's what he enjoyed so much. And, of course, for men, it was the necrophilia. So the Avenue's rapist in Salt Lake City might not be Bundy, but he was certainly suspected of it. And she talked about that. She was very concerned that he might be involved in it. So, anyway, but they're very interesting interviews,
It's interesting, too, you say what she was asking questions. She was asking if all the items were in a bag because he has explained to her that he wore the ski mask to keep his ears warm while shoveling snow. But then she, was suspicious of that, so she asked him about that. But they got a lot of information from her, didn't they, about the fake, mustache. That was established. A lot of things were established from her. It was amazing, really, reading that.
Oh, absolutely. They showed her the picture of the murder kit that was the same one that was in my home. And she recognized the satchel. And she recognized the ski mask and a few of the other items. I don't think she had seen the ice pick or some other things. And Bundy did have an excuse. I remember Ross Davis had told investigators that one time when Bundy's car broke down, he did use the rope to pull Bundy's car that Bundy had. And Bundy was trying to make excuses as to why he would have all this stuff. Of course, you take a look at what he had in this bag. Yeah. I mean, this isn't for what he said it was, although he could use them for, in some cases, some other things. But she said some of the stuff I've seen, and then she named it, and other stuff that I haven't seen. But and she also mentioned in there that she had a type of, what was it, a tire tool? A jack
crowbar.
Handle, but was that the one where she said Bundy wrapped it, and he had wrapped it?
Yeah, a jack handle.
So, So anyway, and I remember Thompson said in the interview, he said, "Well, I'd like to see that before we go back." So I'm assuming that she showed it to him. But she was very forthright, and Jerry said an interesting thing. He said, I can't tell you, like, some things that she wanted to know. He said, I want to, but I can't. He said, not only can I not tell you, I can't even tell anybody, like, in the department except for my partner, just him and his partner. That was it, because he didn't want the stuff, information getting out, even to the other cops, because they may start talking about it then. So he said, Jerry was the kind of guy that he was no nonsense. He could be funny and stuff like that, but he was no nonsense, and he would shoot straight with you, and he wouldn't lie to you. And he was just going to tell it like it is. And he didn't put up with BS from people, and he would call them out on it. So he was a really straight shooter. He had a really interesting way of speaking, too. If you could ever hear him on a tape, he's got like a clipped way of speaking, but he was just, he had like an interesting accent. But in any event, those were really, really, really great interviews. And of course, you take that and you take everything that we know and all these other reports, and throughout my 6 books, you'll find a lot of the really what I call important supplementary reports, and along with commentary, and it just gives people a window. I know I wrote in one of my books, I think it might have been, I don't know if it was The Trail of Ted Bundy or one of them, but I said, these reports that were put together by the detectives, the investigators, I mean, in the back of their head, they may have known that years and years from now, somebody could see them, but they really weren't really thinking about that very much, because in these reports, they would occasionally insult certain people, and they'd put it in print, which makes it really interesting for the researchers and the writers that come around later and put that stuff out. And I've got a couple places, several places, not in Enigma, but in one of my other books where it talks about, and I mention it in the commentary, how they came out. But if you look at and said these things, and they just, it was like in-house humor. And I say I make mention that this is no different than they would, you know, comment to each other about and make jokes about. So they would add these things sometimes to the record. When you think in terms of now being public, you know, you think, oh my gosh, but they wish they could go back and remove that. But the record is extremely interesting, and that's why I tried to put some of the record in my five companion volumes. I should say four plus the encyclopedia. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's also interesting how cooperative she really is at, for the most part, very cooperative, especially when they're asking her things that they think is very relevant, but it would be so difficult for her to answer. And those are questions about his sex, their sex life, and his proclivities per se.
Yeah. Well, she was very open about it. And, you know, at one point she said, I remember Thompson said to her, he said, you know, was Bundy the kind of person that could, you know, go one after the other over and over and over? And she said, well, you know, when we first met, but, you know, after, you know, we were together 6 years, after a while he was just normal. And he said, okay, yeah. He said, I understand that. But, yeah, the investigators looked at Liz as someone who was trying to do the right thing and having difficulty. But the thing people need to understand about Liz is that when the rubber was meeting the road, she was still going to do what she thought was right. When she had the momentary doubts about Bundy, it wasn't volitionally. She said, I'm going to be obstinate to the cops because I'm going to defend Bundy. She wasn't one of these folks that were going to defend somebody that she thought was guilty. So even though she had struggles, you know, even though when she got around Bundy, she could feel that pull to think, oh, I must be wrong about this. He couldn't be doing all these things. He's too loving. He's too nice. But I remember in one of the reports that I have in one of my books, the investigator said, that Liz is back on Bundy's side and she's not being cooperative. But even they understood what was going on. They understood that she had come forward. She had told them a lot. She was vacillating, but not vacillating because she wanted to. She was vacillating between the possibilities of his guilt and the possibilities of his innocence. And if he was innocent, she's doing him a great injustice. And this is important too. She felt like if he was innocent, that some of the things that she was saying about Bundy could harm him in his future together with her, of not just being able to be a lawyer, but going into politics. Because she thought if he is innocent and this turns out to be someone else, look what I've done to his reputation. So she dealt with a lot. And a lot of people judge Liz, and I think in ways that they shouldn't, by being flippant about this. You know, she should have just automatically and never gone back on it and just figured out it was him. And boy, it's always easy to speak for somebody else's life and not your own. But when you're in the midst of something that's so emotional, and after all, she loved Bundy. And she thought Bundy loved her. And in a way that only a psychopath can, I suppose he did. But it was not the kind of love that normal people would say is love. But the bottom line is, she had a rough time, and I think in the end, investigators understood it.
All right. Let's use this as an opportunity, Kevin, to stop for a second for these commercials. Now, we talked about Elizabeth Clofer's cooperation with police. Let's talk about some of the issues that you deal with uniquely in this book, specifically when you talk about Bundy and victims Janice Ott, abducted July 14th, 1974, and there's an issue about the park and returning to convince Denise Naslund to go with him as well. You discuss a couple of these issues in this book. Maybe you can expound upon that issue and tell us what you believe now and what you're trying to explain in this book regarding that issue.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is his nighttime attacks, daylight, and then back in the night. Is that what you're referring to?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, good. All right. You know, having been immersed in this case for so many years now, and having interviewed the kind of people I've interviewed, gone over the case files, just thousands and thousands and thousands of case files, and writing about this man in this case, you get to know it really well, and there's a lot of things that start to gel. There's been times in the past when I have made speculations about what may have happened, although we didn't know the answer, and it only later come to find out. Somebody would contact me, like Lorraine Fargo did, last person to speak with Kathy Parks. She confirmed two of them. And so I never try to speculate in books, except I wanted to do some speculation in Enigma. And the type of speculation that's based on a lot, as far as I'm concerned, circumstantial evidence. And I did this before in a place in the Bundy murders, and when Lorraine Fargo contacted me after the Bundy murders was published, and she said, well, you were right about both those things, and here's why. So it was confirmed. Now, when I was speaking I've been invited to speak at the Kane University in Pittsburgh in September of 2019.
Right.
What I do, when I get information or I come to a place where I've made a decision about something Bundy likely did, I won't announce that publicly. I'll wait for the book to come in print. However, I had deduced from my investigations of Bundy that it was clear that he started attacking women at night, and then come July 14th, we'll go into it deeper, it was a bold daylight abduction, and then he went back into nighttime things. So when I met Duquesne at the serial killer conference, I spoke about this for the first time. I knew I was going to end up putting it in print. I didn't know when, didn't know how. And then later, when Enigma came, I decided to do Enigma. It went in there. But basically, it was this. When Bundy first started, and Bundy never talked about this, and to my knowledge, the investigators never pursued this angle at all. Not anywhere in the record, not with anyone I've ever talked to. However, when Bundy first did, we know he did the Karen Sparks thing, where he got into her unlocked apartment in the middle of the night. You might call it wee hours of the morning, middle of the night. And then she didn't die, so his next victim, Laura Ann Healy, probably got her between 2 and 4 a.m. That's roughly the time that he likely did this. Karen Scavelm went to bed. I think she said she was asleep by 1:30. He wasn't in the house at that time. But he came in and got her. Now, all of these were nighttime abductions until, that we know of the ones we know about, only nighttime abductions. Now, that was his comfort zone. And I speak about this in the Bundy murders. That was his comfort zone, and that it would take him a while before he would get the daylight attacks. But I didn't cover in the Bundy murders about what I'm really saying here. And he's first spotted that we know of on the campus of Central Washington State College in Ellensburg in the afternoon, hunting, but nobody really knows it, in the afternoon, but doesn't obtain a victim. But he did obtain his victim at around 10:30 on April 17th. He was there on a couple of days, and he got Susan Rancourt on April 17th, 1974. It was dark. It was around 10:30 p.m., and I put in Enigma the times of sundown and the times that he got his victims. Now, when we get to this is how it basically maintained. He maintained this nighttime stuff for the most part, of the ones we know. But come July 14th, 1974, he did something he had never done, and that was he went to Lake Sammamish State Park, which is east of Seattle. And there were 40, it was a beautiful, beautiful day. And I went back in 2015, and I wanted to be there on July 14th, but I was up in Oregon. I was down in Oregon doing some research, and I didn't get back to Washington State. We had come down from Washington State, and I was at Lake Sammamish on July 15th of 2015. But that day too was beautiful, but there was nobody there. But just some people. But the day Bundy was there, it was 40,000 people. There were even companies there having picnics, and there was one, a police department was having a picnic. But he was able to, in broad daylight, abduct Janice Ott before noon. People saw him, saw Ott, heard conversations, heard him say that his name was Ted, she was Janice, and he got her. Then he came back later that afternoon after having Janice Ott likely tied to a tree or tied up and sexually assaulted and then likely tied to a tree and gagged. And then he came back and got Denise Maslin around 4:30. However, Bundy never talked about it. And the investigators apparently never asked him about it, to my knowledge. But he must have been bothered by all the attention that he brought on himself during those double daylight abductions. Now, frankly, just between you and me, even though he wasn't satiated with Ott, Bundy was so arrogant by this point of thinking he could get away with everything. He was a much bolder individual, that I think he was really trying to make a statement that day. It was just like a boast. And so once he drew all this information to him, he wasn't happy about it, obviously. And he must have rethought the entire thing, because after Lake Sammamish, he goes back into hunting at night. And this is July of 1974, so he goes on to Utah in that September. And he's like a kid in a candy store. He kills four women in a matter of weeks that we know of. Probably some more, but could be some more. But the bottom line is all at night. It's all after sundown. But by the time he gets over to, I guess it's like April 6th maybe, unless I'm screwing up the date, but I think that Denise Oliverson was April 6th. I'd have to check. But it was definitely spring. That was the first daylight abduction that we know of, and he felt confident to grab her in broad daylight. And it was really bold, because anybody, if you've ever seen, if you could see where it was in Grand Junction, it was in he could have easily been spotted from many directions, and he probably abducted her by whacking her, pulling the head of her far enough, and she rode by with her bike, and he probably whacked her. He may have not had to whack her, maybe convince her of something, but I have a feeling from where she was, because she was going somewhere. I don't imagine he coaxed her to going with him. It was probably just a very quick attack. And so that was the first time back. So, he had retreated from this daylight thing because he had brought so much heat on him and gone back into the nighttime attacks. I thought that was a interesting observation, and one that is likely correct. And for me, it's not even likely. All the evidence is there.
You deal with other things as well, with other people that have studied this and their notions about, again, that he wasn't, to take out the Chi Omega Florida murders, notwithstanding, the idea that he was not a random killer at some times. Please explain this as you do in the book. This notion of random killing, and that wasn't done by Bundy, apparently.
Well, here's what I have considered and what I've written about as far as opportunistic. First of all, Bundy was an exceedingly good planner of murder. We all know this. He was never better at it than he was in Washington State, because he not only was a good planner, but he had picked the body dumps and so on like that. He was still pretty really good, too. In Utah, he had scanned the areas. He didn't have body dumps per se. All his victims there were either discarded or buried, and I don't think he had an actual dump that he would return to. So it was a little bit different in Utah. And, of course, by the time he got to Florida, if you look at the Chi Omega attacks, they don't even appear to be Bundy-like. And he had been so long since he had killed that it was more like a rampage. It was all that pent-up murderous energy. But then the leech killing, his last victim, the little girl in Lake City, they could be more like Bundy. But even there, he was on a downhill slide. But is that basically what you were referring to, or did you have another angle that I'm just missing?
Well, the idea that someone said that it wasn't random, but there was, as you mentioned, that sometimes it was just a matter of he was very organized, but other times he was opportunistic and then hatched a plan in a hurry.
Absolutely.
Just some of the other things that you deal with, too, is that some people have said in the confession, and I know this is jumping ahead a little bit, but in his confessions, he would not mention or admit to certain women's names or girls' names. And you, again, discuss why that might be.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. Well, here's the thing. All right, let's take... Bundy alluded to some things when he was working with Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth. And, well, of course, they're the authors of The Only Living Witness, and they turned their tapes in the book, the tapes of Bundy, into conversations with a killer. And Michaud did most of the interactions with him while Hugh went ahead and went out west and just gathered all the information and did the investigation. But Hugh had dealings with him, too. It's really funny if you listen to conversations with a killer or you're reading it. Hugh Ainsworth, he insults Bundy a couple of times, which is really funny. But the bottom line is he would speak in the third person. But when he got down to his end-of-life confessions, he said, I did this, I did that. However, there were still people that he wouldn't talk about. And it became clear to me over my years of research that, by and large, it's probably going to have to do with not college-age women that he won't talk about, but teenage girls or even preteen girls. In one of the tapes Bundy made where he was speaking in the third person about a serial killer, which he was really talking about himself, he had mentioned that this person may have killed as many as a half a dozen or a dozen, really, like young girls. And I know that when he was talking with Bob Keppel at the end to cover the Washington State murders, Keppel asked him when this started, and he did admit that he killed a hitchhiker in Tumwater, Washington, which is south of Seattle, about 30 minutes. It's south of Seattle. And he had picked her up and he had murdered her. And he did not identify her. And it's interesting, if you look at the confessions of Bundy, again, just like you say, there were certain people he would talk about and name and certain people he wouldn't. And the ones that he likely wouldn't are probably those that are preteens and teenagers or even preteens. I've got in my case file some people that disappeared in areas where Bundy was hunting when he was hunting. And a lot of the MO seems similar to Bundy, but like in one case, it's a 10-year-old girl, and there's just no proving it. But I interviewed a girl named Michelle Coleman, Nelson. Nelson's her married name. Her father was in Washington State at various TV stations. He worked for the newspaper for a while. He just had a nice career out there in media. And Bundy tried to grab her on her way to school, going to her bus stop. And she was like I think around 12. And she was just a young kid. You should see her picture. And come to find out, through another person that I know that's doing Bundy research, Bundy tried to get another young girl. in almost exactly the same area, just a number of blocks away, who was also young. Now, these are the kind of abductions, had they been successful, he wouldn't talk about. So when Keppel's talking to him, and he admits that he had one killing in Tumwater from the hitchhiker in 73, he then says, and there was a homicide in 72, and as soon as he said it, and it was very matter-of-fact, and Keppel knew he meant it, pressed him on it, but he took it back, he wouldn't talk about it. And I personally think, and this is something else based on, we may never be able to prove it, I'm sure we won't, but based on what Bundy has said, his record, and what he wouldn't talk about, except in the third person, it was likely a teenage girl or preteen. And if you look at the confessions for Keppel, Bundy admitted to killing 11 in Washington, but he was only named 8. And so there were 3 unknown. So why would he hold back on that? I think it's likely they were young girls, and he didn't want to talk about that. Same thing in Utah. He admitted to Dennis Couch there were 8,
right,
but he only touched on the names of 5. So who are they? You got a case where he's trying to save his life, the murder of women that were in college, and he had no trouble talking about them. But yet, these other people he wouldn't name. Why wouldn't he name those? Because he was fighting for his life. The reason why, and I know that Bob Keppel's talked about this and other people, he was just too embarrassed to admit it. In other words, his first victim could have been Anne-Marie Burr, but she was 8. I think it's likely that he did that one. Can't say everything that I know about it now because I got a friend who's doing some research on it and he's got some theories and I don't want to talk about it, but I think it's likely Bundy did that one. We will probably never know for sure, but she was 8, so that was his first murder, I believe. But we do know that he did kill 12-year-old Lynette Culver, Pocatello, Idaho. He said that he thought she was a little bit older, like 14, 15 maybe, but still that's not an adult woman, so we know that he did, but he had to talk about that one. And he also did not want to talk much about the Kim Leach murder, which we know his last victim was 12. So the ones that I think he's not talking about, probably of similar age, but likely younger. And those are the ones that he took to his grave with him. And you could find reports, as I said, in my files, I've got reports of girls, young girls missing in surrounding states where Bundy could have operated and likely operated. And, so they're there. And I see these knowing what I know. And I go, that could very well be him, but we'll never be able to prove it. So, yeah, it's interesting to think of that. And yet I don't think it's going to be one of those things that we'll be able to confirm.
It's fascinating, the Detective Dennis Couch and the final confession, Bundy's final confession, and things I think that people either forget or, again, it's not so focused on is the holding of victims. And so Dennis Couch actually asked questions of Bundy about keeping people like Nancy Wilcox and Melissa Smith. So he talked about those and Deborah Kent. And so he wanted to know those particulars. And so in this book, you have some of those particulars about holding some of these people like Melissa Smith. And also you talk about not only was the apartment and the idea that he had to take apartment, but that there was a cellar that wasn't so well known. So could you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, Mike Fisher is the investigator. When I was writing the Bundy murders, I was doing that research in 2006 through 2008, late 2008, and that's when I finished the book. My research into the Bundy murders started really in 2005 after my initial meeting with Jerry. But I had to read all the Bundy books to see what was there and all that stuff and doing some preliminary stuff. So it was like 2.5 years. But it was Mike that first told me that he suspected that Bundy had some people in his apartment. And he was thinking at the time like the utility room, but I thought, well, that's, you know, a little bit on the cramped side. I don't, possible. And I didn't know about the cellar, and I don't think Mike knew about the cellar either. I'm not sure. But if you read in the confessions, when I say confessions, Bundy is theorizing about things. And when Michelle talks about carrying something, people in and out of his apartment, Bundy goes into it, and he said, you know, it's probably, you know, whoever would do something like that, carrying something in or out of their apartment or something. And, you know, he was basically saying it's almost like crazy that we're not dealing with somebody that was totally rational, because he said he just, you know, a person like that must think he can walk through walls. So he, Bundy addressed it there. Now, a lot of people have taken great pains to think that he didn't do that. And a lot of people just mock it. And it's true that there was a cellar that after I wrote the Bundy verse, sometime after that, just really a number of years ago, he was the apartment manager, and he would show apartments. He would do cutting the grass. And he had, if you go in the back of the house and you're standing there and you look to the right, there are steps that are covered by a lid, and there's a lock on it, and you can unlock that and go down to the cellar area. So he no doubt had some of his victims down there. And I think likely it was probably Debbie Kent and maybe Nancy Wilcox, because he had them only for a very, very short period of time. But he did admit I took them up to my apartment. So did he take them all the way up to the apartment? Probably not. He probably had them there. And I know there's a fellow that lives at 565 First Avenue who said, I used to hear Bundy down there all the time. So it's possible he could use the cellar only, but I don't think so. I think it's likely, and this would go exactly with Bundy's arrogance and with what he told Michelle. I was discussing this a couple months ago with somebody who's also a researcher, and he thinks it's likely just the cellar. And I said, but if you look at what he said to Michelle, it doesn't appear like it's just a cellar at all. Because I said, I've been there twice to this place, and you could pull up at night, dark, it's very dark, open up your trunk, which is in the front of his car, open up that thing and just get her in there within seconds. I said, if you look at what he told in the show, it doesn't appear like he's talking about something so easy. He's talking about transferring in and out of apartments. And I said to this person, think of the Healy, and I wrote this in the book. I said, think of the Healy abduction in reverse, where he carried Lindan Healy out into a university district, carried her out, probably with just a blanket thrown over her, could have been seen by anybody. Kids in university districts are coming and going at all hours of the night. And it didn't bother Bundy. So I said, you know, I've been to this apartment. He could have parked on the side of the house, wait, make sure that the coast was clear, and go up the front steps and up to his room, and he would be able to get up there in under a minute, even with a body. And I said, if you look at what, you know, says with Michelle, that's the kind of risk that I think he's talking about. And that way, because he had at least two of his victims for a number of days, that would be Melissa Smith and Laura Ann Amy. And I've seen the autopsy photos of Laura Ann Amy. She is pristine. There is no decay whatsoever. And she was found on Thanksgiving of 1974, but she was abducted on late October 31st, really into the morning, November 1st. And so it wasn't freezing there. Her body wasn't frozen. You got some really cool nights there, but usually it doesn't go below freezing. So this body looked pristine. So where's he going to have that body? In the cellar the whole time? I kind of doubt that. He would have liked the comfort of his own room. And if you look at what he said to Michelle, it's real clear he's talking about inside and outside of the apartment. So I told my friend, I said, it just, for me, it just doesn't gel. It just doesn't gel that he would just take him down in that cellar. Although he probably very much had Smith and Wilcox there. And that's another thing. It's really interesting. for some reason, and I don't know why Bundy did this, he told a totally different story about Wilcox to Michelle than he did. Well, I won't say totally, but pretty radically different as to the event, certain aspects of it. And he, in the Michelle thing, he goes back and says, I didn't know she was dead until I went back there and saw she was dead. Well, he then must have transported her to his home, but doesn't elaborate on it. But in the confession with Couch, he admits he took her there. And he admits that he took Kent there. And he also admits took her there. She wasn't dead, but he killed her, obviously there, but and then took her remains the next day. So he no doubt did have them in the cellar. I remember I spoke to Jerry Thompson once about Bundy keeping victims there, and he never really thought that he did. But the evidence is there from his statements, not just to Michelle, but, you know, to what he said to Couch at the end. So, you know, you can, there are some people who say he absolutely did not take the them up to his room. You can't say that. The moment you say that about somebody like Bundy is the moment you're going to get snookered, because Bundy would do things just for the thrill of it. And he already told Michelle, this is a man that wasn't thinking clearly. It wasn't being rational. And so, anyway, so I think he had them in both locations.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. So now we're talking about, again, the ideas that maybe some people don't really know, the idea that he would keep his victims, he would deal with young girls and had a an attraction to young girls. You also, let's get to what the interviews with Jerry Thompson and with Don Patchen and with Holmes, Dr. Holmes. And so let's talk first with Jerry Thompson. Again, you had a special relationship with him. He was instrumental in helping you, and the information that you got from him was, again, crucial to the creation of the books that about Bundy that you have written so far. Yeah. Let's talk about the interview with Jerry Thompson and what you have included in this enigma of Ted Bundy.
Yeah, I was really happy to turn that interview, excuse me, into a transcript and bring it to the people for posterity. And I remember dealing with Jerry. I've had so many dealings with Jerry, so many conversations with him off tape, that it was fun finally transcribing what was on tape, because a lot of it I had forgotten. But Jerry was a very unique fella, as I said before, a straight shooter. And I just got to say again, all of these investigators that I dealt with were so extremely open with me and so extremely nice, and they never failed to answer any questions that I had. And if you look in the, I thought it was really interesting. If you look at the transcript of the Jerry Thompson tape, I thought it was really cool when he talked about when he was warning the people in Colorado. He said, "You're not watching him." He said, you know, you let him go down to the Coke machine, and they would go, "Oh, Jerry, Ted's not going to do anything. We could make him a trustee." And I said, the Bundy murders, I said, I mean, here you had a person that was on trial for murder, the murder of Karen Campbell, and suspected of many murders in the Northwest, and they're acting like this guy is just, he's like a choir boy. He's like, "Oh, he's just dead. He's just, yeah, we can make him a trustee." Thompson said, "You know, I don't normally carry my service revolver when I'm there, but he basically said, but I'm going to start because he's going to do something, and if I have to stop him, I'm going to." That's basically what he said. And he talked about how he rubbed it in with them later about that he, "Look, I warned you what he would do, and now, you know, this." And I remember Thompson said during the interview, he talked about later the families of some of the Flora victims contacted him and said, "Do you think we could sue?" because Colorado so failed in keeping, and they did a horrendous job of securing Bundy, escaped twice.
That's right.
Last time he went to Florida. He said, well, I'm not an attorney, so you're going to have to deal with the attorneys on that. But Jerry told me an interesting thing during the tape, and he talked about how Bundy, he said, you know, Bundy used to call him all the time when he was on trial in Utah because he was like a co-counsel. He was helping in his defense. So Thompson said, I talked to him. And Thompson said, I always would ask him about Debbie Kent. And Bundy would end up saying, oh, I don't know anything about her. And he would say, oh, yes, you do. You know, and then I remember one time, and in there, in the transcript, he said, you know, he would ask him this all the time. So they had a number of conversations and what Bundy would call from the jail. And he'd always bring up, Thompson would always bring up Debbie Kent. And I remember I quoted for the book, The Bundy Murders, something that Thompson told me what Bundy said at one point that isn't on the transcript because we talked about his eyes, we talked about reactions of Bundy, we talked about a lot of things off tape. And I include the thing in the Bundy murders where Thompson said one day when Bundy called me, Thompson said, he said, well, I want to ask you about Debbie. And Bundy started laughing. You could hear him laughing through the phone. He said, ah, Debbie, you'll have to ask somebody else about that. And, you know, he was laughing. So this is something that Thompson always, again, the straight shooter that he was, and I think Bundy, I think there was a part of Bundy that might have respected that, but also Bundy felt such contempt for Thompson because Thompson was so instrumental in, you know, finding out who Bundy was and really bringing him to light in Utah. And, you know, Bundy used to do the same thing with Mike Fisher. You know, he was, you know, he respected Mike, but he hated the fact that he was tracking him so. And, of course, Mike was the first detective who ever got a warrant of murder placed against Bundy. And so, but anyway, the transcripts of Jerry's conversations with me, that interview, is very enlightening. And I knew people would you know, want to read it. So I'm glad I got that down in the book for posterity.
Absolutely. You really capture his character in the exchange between Ted and Jerry Thompson. It's fascinating, and it's an amazing part of this book. Let's get to Florida. Don Patchen is the lead detective in the Chi Omega murders in Florida, and you met him through Jim Massey. And Jim Massey, you say, was instrumental in introducing you to some other important people connected to the case. And then you talk about Ron Holmes, the criminologist. So maybe we'll talk about Ron Holmes first and his visit with Ted Bundy and also about this film interview that fell through. Maybe tell us, as you write in the book, about Ron Holmes, his book, and that interview.
It was really interesting. You know, you never know when you meet somebody what the outcome will be. If I wouldn't have ever become friends with Jim Massey, I would have never written about Bundy. There would be no six books. So that we wouldn't be talking today. We might have been talking at another time about another killer, but we wouldn't have been talking about Ted Bundy. But Massey had been friends with Ron Holmes for a number of years. And it was through Massey that I met Jerry Thompson and got them to bring the murder kit in my home. And that's really what started rolling. So Massey introduced me to Jerry Thompson and also introduced me to Dr. Al Carlisle and got me in, talked to Al. Al said, yes, I'll speak with Kevin and started that. Massey also said, now I also know Mike Fisher. And I know Don Patchen. I don't have contact information for them anymore, but if you locate them, tell them you know me, and I did. And it was also, Rome, Holmes was, it was hard, it was very difficult. It's very difficult for people to get an appointment to interview Holmes or to even speak with Holmes at the time. He's very selective who he talks to. But Massey and Holmes worked together. And in fact, in Ron Holmes' books, you know, Ron Holmes was a really known, well-known criminologist. He's gone now, but he had written books on serial murder with a guy named DeBerger, and he'd also written some with his son. And he's got all these academic books, and he's well known. Well, he got in touch with Bundy back in the mid 1980s, and he sent Bundy his resume just to let him know who he was. And Bundy liked Holmes, and they got together. And Holmes went down there and interviewed Bundy all day once, from that morning in the prison to broke for lunch, came back, interviewed him throughout the afternoon. And when I was interviewing Bob Keppel, Keppel said to me, because you know, Keppel knows Holmes, he goes, Ron Holmes was set to be Bundy's golden boy back in the mid-1980s. That is, had they not had a falling out, Keppel believes that it would be Holmes that he would have done all his confessing to. That they ended up having a falling out. There's a couple theories about that. But what was so interesting is that I sat with Jim Massey one night several years before I was ever decided. I mean, I didn't even know I'm going to write anything about Bundy. We were having coffee at a restaurant one night, and Jim Massey brought all these letters that Bundy had written Holmes. While we're drinking coffee, I sat there and read all of them. And that other researcher that I'm talking about, that is currently doing some stuff, he's read all the letters from Holmes to Bundy, but he's never read the ones from Bundy to Holmes. I said, I've read them all. I said, unfortunately, I didn't copy those. I didn't make copies of those. If anybody was going to do anything with them, and then Massey put them back in the storage, and several years later when I was writing the Bundy murders, he couldn't locate them. I still may be able to obtain those, even though Holmes is gone, and I think I'm going to try. But the bottom line is they were scheduled to go down, and I should say this, because they were doing all this, Jim Massey traveled to Utah twice and did a lot of research concerning the Utah murders. He also became personal friends with the Kent family and with Jim Amy. And it was really a very close friendship between him and Jim Amy. And when he was with Jim Amy, they were driving by where Laura was found. Jim Amy just blurted out, he said, "My baby was up there all by herself, and like I couldn't do anything to help her." And as I say in the book, my friend Jim Massey thinks that Jim Amy passed away long before he should have due to the stress of the murder of his daughter. But
sure.
Holmes had a falling out, and there's two stories on that. But what they were going to do, Bundy had been to Utah twice, met all these people, met Carlisle, met Thompson, gotten a real friendship going with all these people back in the 80s, back in the early to mid-80s, actually. I think he might have even started the research even before Holmes had, I think so, even before Holmes had gotten involved with Bundy. But the bottom line is he had done all this research, and Holmes always mentioned him in his books and said Jim contributed so much to the research that they had on Bundy's Utah, you know, murders. Anyway, they were supposed to go down, and they were getting all ready to go down, and they were going to do another interview of Bundy, and Massey was going to go along and film the interview.
Right.
And then they had a falling out, and so that never took place. And I know Jim Massey would have loved having done all this investigation into Bundy. They would have loved to have gone down there and filmed that and witnessed that, but he never had a chance. And there's two stories on what happened there. Holmes told me when I interviewed. Oh, that's another thing. I called Holmes twice when I was researching the book. I could never get in to see him. So Massey said, "Let me call Ron, and I'll get you in." And he did. And so Ron was at that time, he was coroner in Louisville, in the office of the coroner, as well as he was a part of the Southern Police Institute here in Louisville at the University of Louisville campus, and people came from all over to do training and stuff like that for it. It was kind of like a hub for that, and it's still there. But he would, so so they were set to do all this, and but then this falling out occurred, and Holmes told me that the falling out had to do with, and this sounds just like Bundy, had to do with Bundy was wanting him to buy Carol, his, you know, his wife at that time. I guess he'd already married her. Yeah, of course he had, because that was at the end of the leech thing. Because she was going to go back to school. She was going to be in graduate school down there in Florida. And Holmes said, I'm not going to do that. He said, you know, if I'm going to buy anybody a computer, you know, things aren't cheap, especially back then. He said, I would do that for one of my kids. So he was going to do that. And he said that was the reason. And now, and I think it might be a combination of both, frankly. But Massey told me that Holmes had also sent Bundy a magazine article he had published in like some federal magazine, and had talked about Bundy, and that Bundy got irritated about that. There was a really good full-length article with pictures published in the Louisville Courier Journal in a magazine section, I think back in 1986. No, probably maybe 1988. I'm not sure. I'll have to check. But the falling out with Bundy had already occurred, and they quote from certain things. And I know Bundy was upset about a couple of things. I think Bundy wanted to sway on something, and Holmes didn't necessarily see it that way. So whatever happened, there was this falling out, and then that never occurred. Now, it's true, even though Keppel said that Holmes would have been the one he'd done all his confessions to, it would have really been one of these deals where it was like Bill Hagemeyer, because he was working with Bill Hagemeyer. Bundy was at the end, and you know, Hagemeyer sat in on every confession, but Bundy had to make the confession to the states, to the detectives of the states where with this happened. But I do believe that Holmes would have played an even more influential part in all of this towards the end. So, but it's just very interesting. So I had to thank Jim about getting me in with Holmes, and then once Holmes knew me, you know, we had had that. Oh, it was so interesting too, because the phone rang twice while I was interviewing Holmes in his office, and the first time it was his wife, and each time a call came in, I would just hit the off button on the recording. I say this in enigma. The second call came in, it was Stephen Michaud. And I said, had I known that was Michaud, I'd have left it funny. I thought that was interesting that while I'm there interviewing Holmes about Bundy, there comes a call from Michaud. And so he said, that is Stephen Michaud on the phone. And I said, oh, okay. So he said, yeah, he said, we talk occasionally. So anyway, it's just interesting. Yeah. I'm glad. You know, the neat thing about all this is recording people while they're alive. And now, you know, who have we lost? Holmes is gone. Lorraine Fargo's gone. Jerry Thompson's gone. Al Carlisle's gone, you know. And it won't be that many years, you know, in the future, and the rest of these people will be gone. So it's recording things while there's time. And that is the main reason why, after I wrote the Bundy murders, I spent years and didn't write anything about Bundy except to comment on that thing or give talk, you know, talk to documentarians or do podcasts like with you and all that. But I wasn't writing about Bundy. And I remember somebody came to me and said, this New York Times bestselling author, this said, look, why don't we do a book together about Bundy, having to do with some murders he may have committed. I just really didn't want to do it. And I passed on. I mean, I knew we'd make some money, but I just didn't want to do it. But then when some people started getting sick, some really prominent people in the case, and one person had passed away, I said, and this is in 2015, I said, you know, if I'm ever going to do a follow-up book, I need to do it now before more people are gone. And that's why I wrote The Trail of Ted Bundy. And just like the Bundy murders, I got a lot of great new interviews from valid people that worked with Bundy. And, of course, I was so pleased that I decided to write that second book, The Trail of Ted Bundy. But the Bundy murders came out in 2009. I didn't write anything. And then in 2015, I went down that other one, and the Trail of Ted Bundy, picking up the untold story, then that was published. And then, of course, that started more contacts with me from other people, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. And then the rest of these, what I call the six-book series.
It was interesting, Ronald Holmes the criminologist, he concluded, and it wasn't, again, it was hard to say, I would imagine, but he said that he identified a fractured identity syndrome, and he related it to Anne-Marie Burr with the contention that Bundy killed at 14 or 15 years of age. Can you explain what he meant by this fractured identity syndrome and the event that may have caused that?
Yeah. In speaking with the murder of Anne-Marie Burr, Bundy always denied it, except when he talked to Holmes, it is absolutely clear he implicated himself in that murder. And you'll read that in the Bundy murders and also some follow-up books. He implicated himself in it. And Holmes was absolutely convinced that he did it. But Holmes did talk about the fractured personality aspect, and he said he wrote an article for one of these federal magazines on it. And I think what he is doing, he was well aware of the work of Hervey, The Mask of Sanity, which was originally published in 1941, and quickly at some point he revised that book over the years, and I don't know how many revisions it took place, but I remember Cleckley said once that there was the revisions were so heavy and some point it was almost like writing a new book. But he, even Cleckley interviewed Bundy at some point, apparently. And at least that's what I was told by some other people who should know. But the bottom line is this fractured identity syndrome, when Holmes was talking to me about that, he said, you know, there were people, if this is going to happen, it usually happens young in life, can be trauma that caused it to happen. And he said, I always thought it was really interesting Holmes said this, you know, if Bundy did kill Burr, Holmes said that, you know, he would have been 15. He was off there. Exactly 14. But he said, you know, at the age that most people are thinking about girls and stuff like that, that here's this person with this fractured personality thinking about murder. And so it's like, Holmes said, I'm trying to figure out who I am, you know, and then this person is already knowing who he is in that bad sense, and he's committing murder. So, you know, Holmes saw Bundy almost like on another plane, as it were, another level that most people don't find themselves on, and that Bundy, for whatever reason, found himself on this other level that most people never go to at a very young age. And I remember he said here he was at 15, he knew all about who he was. And the traumatic aspects, I mean, Holmes knows that people can suffer trauma and not turn into something like that. But the circumstances must have been right. And this is why I've said this at the symposium in front of other people that were there on the panel who are experts in this stuff and not just writers. But I said to the audience, I said, as much as we learn about chemical things that happen in the brain of these people and the differences, I said, not only do they not know for a certainty why these people are this way, I don't think they're ever going to know. At the same time, you can kind of figure out things about killers. And I know John Douglas has said one of the first things we did when we were in the behavioral science unit, which is now, I guess, the behavioral analysis unit, that they said that one big thing that they had was killers born or are they made? And I remember he said in the case of Kemper, Edmund Kemper, said in his case, he believes he was more made than born that way. And then others are the proclivity to do things like this or to go that way may come into them at birth. But no matter what it is, there's a variety of reasons why people turn out this way. And I don't think they're ever going to get to the actual one reason. But the fractured identity syndrome is something that happens. That, and again, without calling it that, I use more Kleckley's language in the Bundy murders. I talk about this fractured personality. And that's what Kleckley talked about. They're fractured. You can't see it. You know, Bundy said something very interesting at one point. He said when he was growing up, he had these two friends. They were great friends of his, Jerry Stolwick and Warren Dodge. And he and Dodge were born like 20 minutes apart. And they would joke about that. But they were all three of these kids. They were like inseparable. But Bundy would later say he didn't know how to be a friend of hers. It never felt exactly right. In other words, we've all had friends. And when we know we're like and we like them, it just naturally flows. There's not, we don't have to look at it and analyze it. It's just the way it is. And I'm sure with Terry Stolwick and Warren Dodge, they were just all three friends. And there wasn't, they weren't analyzing their friendship. It was just, it's what it was. With Bundy, he had a hard time relating. It's all unspoken. He wouldn't tell this to anybody. But he had a hard time relating as being a friend and doing it. It never felt right to him. And so I make the posit in the Bundy murders that, it's one thing to be like a mixed up youth, not understanding who you are, not feeling normal. You're going to have all the sympathy in the world for people like that. And then it's another thing to go from that to becoming a predator of women and a destroyer of women. And, it doesn't surprise me that there are occasions when people feel a certain way. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that grow up like this and don't understand some of the disconnects they have, but almost all of them will never go into murder. So even with something like that, where they have a fractured personality, most people still do not do the acts that are Ted Bundy, but yeah, some do. And so there's other factors there as well. So about fractured personality, I think this is the best thing we can say about it. We can see the results of it. We can partly understand it. But when it gets down to the nitty-gritty of why somebody like Ted Bundy became Ted Bundy, I don't think they're going to figure that one out.
No. Let's talk about Don Patchen, because it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. He in the writing in the book, he talks about June, or you interview him 2008, uh-huh, June.
Yeah.
But he talks about first encountering Ted Bundy as this person named Kenneth Misner and these 22 stolen credit cards. So it's fascinating that he talks about his first encounter. Tell us a little bit about what you write about Don Patchen, what he has to say about his encounters with Ted Bundy.
Well, I had a friend say to me, he said, like until I read your book, I thought Don Patchen was kind of like a rube or somebody. He just didn't know and stuff. I said, oh, no, God. Patchen was a great investigator. He was really a sharp guy. He was a combat veteran. He did two tours in Vietnam, was wounded, came home and became a cop. Clear thinker, just really sharp at what he does. Well, when he got that call one night that there was a guy arrested in Pensacola who had identified himself as Kenneth Misner, who was in Tallahassee, a pretty well-known track star, and he had all these stolen credit cards on him and things like that, but this is who he identified himself with. Well, he had to call Steve Botiford. Don Patchen was the lead detective, ended up being the lead detective in the Kyle Omega case for the Tallahassee PD. And so when this Meisner fellow was captured in Pensacola with all these credit cards that were linking him to Tallahassee, he called Steve Botiford, detective with the Lehigh County Sheriff's Department, and they had to travel to Pensacola. And so you know, they get there, and this is who he says he is, and apparently that he and Mazur somewhat resemble themselves, but then they found out that the real Mazur calls it, that's not me. And so they find out while they're down there interviewing this guy that he's not Meisner. And for a very brief time, you'll see in the reports he's identified as Mr. Doe, but then it almost immediately goes to Bundy, because Bundy had said to them, he had said, you know, if you let me make a couple personal calls, I'll tell you who I am. And it's really going to, he said, you know, he said, this is going to make you famous. And Patchen laughed. He said, oh, yeah, well, why is it going to make us famous? And anyway, so came out, of course, he's Ted Bundy. Nobody, when they hear the name, they go, who's Ted Bundy? And then, of course, these calls start coming in from Keppel, Fisher, people like that. And but Patchen was an astute detective. And what I loved about interviewing him, and by the way, he's still alive. He's had a tremendous amount of problems. I was supposed to go down and see him before COVID hit, and so we had to cancel all that. And he's got some operations he's going to go through, but he's actually going to give me his entire case file, and he wants me to have it. He told me, he said, even if I'm not alive, by the time you come down here, I've already instructed my wife that I want you to have it. And, you know, just like with the rest of these guys, we developed a really good friendship. And Paxton's a really, really, really nice fellow. But as a detective, he was really sharp. So I'm going to go down this summer and spend a couple days with him and I'm honored to pick up the case file and bring it home and add it to the thousands and thousands of pages I already have. And but he's just a great guy. Very analytical in his thinking. And one thing he said about the credit cards, he said, it's unusual for someone to admit that they've stolen these cards. And that is what this Bundy fellow did. That is what this Mr. Doe did at first when he got out of Bundy. He said, usually criminals will say, oh, no, that must have been in the car. Yes, I'm in a stolen car. I get it. But those were already here. But he said Bundy had no trouble admitting that that was him. He stole the cards, he said. So, see, that's like a tip-off. Because the main thing in Bundy's mind was not being connected to murder.
That's right.
The credit card thefts alone meant he was going to prison for many years. He would be convicted of that. Many years, without question. So, anyway. But Patchen's a great guy. He's still around. I don't know how long he'll be around, but hopefully. I told Don, I said, Don, you keep defeating everything, and I like that. And he said, yeah, I got two cardiologists. I got this, I got that, I got the other. And last time, when I was supposed to go down before, he had developed sepsis, and he was in the hospital, and he was having trouble, and he had an operation. And they thought he wasn't going to make it. And his wife said, listen, you just do everything you can possibly do and don't give up on him. And he made it again. So he's like the cat with not 9 lives. He's a cat with about 20 lives. But I like that. And anybody that would meet Patchen, they would like him immediately. He's really a great guy. All these detectives are this way. They're just very, very nice people.
Mm-hmm. You talked that Ted had told him that it was like being a vampire in these about 40 hours worth of interviews, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, Bundy came off that way. He came off that way to Thompson, too. And Thompson said the same thing. And in fact, when Boniford, and despite, you know, the interviews of Bundy began at Pensacola, and the lead detective on the case in Pensacola was Norman Chapman. But when Bundy was transferred to Tallahassee, Chapman was out of that portion of the case, and it was just Steve Boniford, Don Patchen, and then whomever in Tallahassee was wanting to interview him, but basically those two. But they had said that Bundy at one point told Boniford and Patchen to turn off the tape, stop the tapes for a minute. And he did. And as he was doing this, he went in to the things that he likes to do. And he said, sometimes I feel like a vampire. And you know, he said, you don't understand the significance of Officer Lee stopping me in Pensacola and arresting me, and what happened in Utah when I was arrested, but when you know more, you will. And I've seen the sheet where Patchen was scribbling these notes. I've got a copy of it. And Bosley was doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Even though the tapes were off, Bundy may not have realized it, but this stuff was submitted into evidence. And here's the thing about dealing with killers. There's a lot you're going... There's a person out there who's a researcher, and this individual doesn't want to take anything, even from detectives, that isn't on tape. And I said to this person once, I said, if you're going to do that, you're going to miss a lot of stuff. Because a lot of things that they've said to these men and women are not on tape. And in fact, if you've seen the movie Mindhunter, where they're sitting down with their tape recording and taking notes, none of that happened. John Douglas said, we never used recorders. We took notes only. Because if we'd use a recorder, they'd have backed off. They would have clammed up. And so a lot of stuff has come out from what these detectives have gleaned from these killers that was never on tape. And, you know, the courts, when Patch and Bolliford wanted to submit this into evidence, they didn't say, well, did you get that on tape? No. He told us this. He said, turn off the tapes. It was admitted into the record. And so, you know, it's very important. And so Bundy, when he said turn off the tape, he probably thought, well, I'll just be able to tell some things about how I feel, what I deal with, and it's going to stay with us, okay? But it didn't, and it came out. And I know one thing he said is another thing, and I brought this entire thing out in, could be the Bundy Secrets or Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries. I can't remember which. But I go through the whole scenario. I think it's the Bundy Secrets. But he said there was a... He saw a woman one time, and he said, I had to have her. She was like on a bike. And I had to have her. Or she could have been walking. I can't remember. But he said, I had to have her. It was like, that's it. I got to do this. And so he goes into these things to let them know exactly what he's dealing with. And Hanson said at one point, Bundy, and this is what that psychiatrist hired by the defense, his name was Tanay, he said that Bundy hinders his own defense sometimes and will help the prosecution. It's a thing he kind of does. But he told, when they were asking him about the Chi Omega murders, Bundy said to them, and he said, if you ask me flat out, I'm going to say no. But he was saying things to them to let them know that, yes, there are things that are there, but he didn't want to have to come out and say it. But at one point he said, the evidence is there. Look for it. How about that? The evidence is there. Look for it. And, of course, they did. And when Bundy, you know, when he was involved in the Florida trial of Chi Omega, and doing depositions during the, also the, he didn't really, wasn't co-counsel for the Leach trial, but he basically let them do it, but he might have done some depositions, or this, what I'm about to say could have come out in the Lake, not Lake Sands, I'm sorry, but in the Chi Omega thing. But when he was interviewing, I think it was Patchen, and it was Patchen. And he said, Patchen said, well, you know, it can all be cleared up if you could just take us to the, or this was during questioning, you just take us to where the Leach girl is before they discover the body. He said, I can't do that because it's too horrible to look at, which is an admission that he did it. Otherwise, how would he know? Do you see what he was doing? So he's coming out and basically confessing without confessing. So inadvertently, you know, that I say that the defense would like to have tried the case with Bundy in absentia, gone somewhere, because Bundy was the main ingredient to torpedoing his own defense in Florida. yeah, it's just really unbelievable what, if you look at what he did, and so the psychologist, Tenet, touched upon this, about how he's just as likely to hinder his own defense and help the prosecution. You got to ask yourself, why was he doing this? And yet he did it.
Finally, too, before I let you go, Don Patchen talked about Ted Bundy really liking the upcoming show, as he called it, The Execution.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Patchen was there at the electrocution. And he had a last visit with Bundy, and he said, how many did you really kill? And Ted Bundy said, 3 digits.
Yeah.
So there was always this contention of how many did he actually admit to killing. But Don Patchen was there to say, how do you live with it?
Yeah. And because Patchen talked about how cold that was. I mean, how do you live with it? And Bundy rattled something off where you just, you know, learn to live with it or deal with it or something that he said. But, you know, Bundy, he would, in the trial, he would do things. I mean, listen, in the trial, he would get, this is the last thing you should do if you're defending your client, in Bundy's case, your own life. You would not call on someone to then, a detective, and then have them describe the bloody scene within Chi Omega. That's the last thing. It's going to come out anyway. But you don't ever want to bring that stuff out because it's going to paint a picture with the jury and they'll be more likely to convict you and even sentence you to death in the penalty phase because of all the horrors that they've had to witness. Well, Bundy would call on people to describe this stuff. It's the last thing he should have done. It was an absolute gift to the prosecution. And the investigators thought the reason why Bundy did this is because he enjoyed hearing about it. Imagine
right.
that. And yet it was done
be
to his own
it.
Hurt. Yeah.
Well, that's the whole thing. It seems insane that he would turn down this life in prison and risk the death penalty sentence. But also, he loved representing himself. He loved that arena. You know, for the guy that was the wannabe lawyer, the guy that could have been a lawyer, that wasn't a lawyer, that never completed being a lawyer, he was a lawyer.
Never completed it. He thought he was really slick in that area. But yet he never completed it. And he wasn't, he certainly did a lot to hinder his own defense. And of course, when he was convicted in a Chi Omega trial, I mean, the wind would just went out of him, and he didn't do very much at all for the Leach trial. But to think that he was free, not free, but he was free of the death penalty if he had taken that deal in Florida with the prosecution was offering before either trial went forward. Everybody was convinced him to do it, otherwise Florida is going to kill you. But he rejected it. And then, of course, towards the end, he was doing everything he could to save off the execution with his bones fit scheme, but that didn't work.
Yeah, I think his arrogance, he overestimated his own abilities, and then near the end, he was desperate to try to remain alive, and I think he would have enjoyed all this notoriety. I think he would have, you know, what he thought he would regret. I think it would have been a new world of adulation and admiration for a guy like him. He would have really, really enjoyed the upcoming years
in prison, to touch on that, when he was having that conversation, which you've been reading the Bundy murders and also a subsequent book, even in more detail, but when he was talking to that woman that I identified in the Bundy murders as Dawn Kraut, she ran into him in the lunchroom of the cafeteria of the University of Washington as they were talking about it, and she knew he was involved in this case. He said, hopefully people will forget about it. Bundy was very defensive. He said, oh, no, they won't forget about it. They won't forget about it. It's too intricate for, like, them to forget about it. There's just too much there. And that's just it. He was very proud of what he had done. Very proud of where he was in all of this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
And that's, the enigma of Ted Bundy, the questions and controversies surrounding America's most infamous serial killer. Kevin Sullivan, it has been an absolute pleasure talking about the enigma of Ted Bundy. You're all over Amazon. Tell us just about your website or the Amazon page before I let you go.
Yeah, well, the Amazon, you can bring me up, and Amazon will not only display all of my books, but you will, on my author page, but you'll have links to the work that I've done through Wild Blue Press. I have various publishers, but they are mainly my main publisher now, has been for a number of years.
Right.
And there will be links to blogs I've written from Amazon that will take you to Wild Blue Press, or you can go to wildbluepress.com directly, go to their authors, look me up, and I've got a lot of blog posts archived. And in fact, I've just recently written another one in the last couple of days called The Allure of Human Monsters. And so if you Google The Allure of Human Monsters, it'll bring it up on Google, and it'll take you right to Wild Blue Press.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Kevin Sullivan. The Enigma
of
Ted Bundy. It's been great.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, sir. Night.
Good night.